Chapter 1. The Last Chapter. The End of Science. A vital aspect of the enlightened state is the experience of an all-pervading unity. This and that no longer are separate entities. They are different forms of the same thing. Everything is a manifestation. It is not possible to answer the question, manifestation of what, because the what is that which is beyond words, beyond concept, beyond form, beyond even space and time. Everything is a manifestation of that which is. That which is. Beyond these words lies the experience of that which is. The forms through which that which is manifests itself are each and every one of them perfect. We are manifestations of that which is. Everything is a manifestation of that which is. Everything and everybody is exactly and perfectly what it is. A 14th century Tibetan Buddhist, Longchenpa, wrote, "Since everything is but an apparition, perfect in being what it is, having nothing to do with good or bad, acceptance or rejection, one may well burst out in laughter." We might say, God's in his heaven and all's well with the world, except that according to the enlightened view, the world couldn't be any other way. It is neither well nor not well. It simply is what it is. What it is perfectly what it is. It couldn't be anything else. It is perfect. I am perfect. I am exactly and perfectly who I am. You are perfect. You are exactly and perfectly who you are. If you are a happy person, and that is what you perfectly are, a happy person. If you are an unhappy person, then that is what you perfectly are, an unhappy person. If you are a person who is changing, then that is what you perfectly are, a person who is changing. That which is that which is. That which is that which is. There is nothing which is not that which is. There is nothing other than that which is. Everything is that which is. We are a part of that which is. In fact, we are that which is. If we substitute subatomic particles for people in this scheme, we have a good approximation of the conceptual dynamics of particle physics. Yet there is another sense in which this aspect of unity has entered physics. The pioneers of quantum physics noticed a strange connectedness among quantum phenomena. Until recently, this oddity lacked any theoretical significance. It was regarded as an accidental feature which could be explained as the theory developed. In 1964, J.S. Bell, a physicist at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, CERN or CERN in Switzerland, zeroed in on this strange connectedness in a manner that may make it the central focus of physics in the future. Dr. Bell published a mathematical proof which came to be known as Bell's theorem. Bell's theorem was reworked and refined over the following 10 years until it emerged in its present form. Its present form is dramatic, to say the least. Bell's theorem is a mathematical construct which, as such, is indecipherable to the non-mathematician. Its implications, however, could affect profoundly our basic worldview. Some physicists are convinced that it is the most important single work, perhaps, in the history of physics. One of the implications of Bell's theorem is that, at a deep and fundamental level, the separate parts of the universe are connected in an intimate and immediate way. In short, Bell's theorem and the enlightened experience of unity are very compatible. The unexplained connectedness of quantum phenomena shows itself in several ways. The first way we have already discussed. It is the double-slit experiment. When both slits in a double-slit experiment are open, the light waves going through them interfere with each other to form a pattern of alternating light and dark bands on the screen. When only one slit in a double-slit experiment is open, the light waves going through it illuminate the screen in the ordinary way. How does a single photon in a double-slit experiment know whether or not it can go to an area on the screen that must be dark if both slits are open? The great multitude of photons, of which a single photon eventually will be a part, distributes itself in one way if one slit is open, and in an entirely different way if both slits are open. The question is, assuming that a single photon goes through one of the two slits, how does it know whether or not the other slit is open? Somehow it does. An interference pattern always forms when we open both slits, and it never forms when we close one of the slits. However, there is another experiment in which this apparent connectedness of quantum phenomena is even more perplexing. Suppose that we have what physicists call a two-particle system of zero spin. This means that the spin of each of the particles in the system cancels the other. If one of the particles in such a system has a spin up, the other particle has a spin down. If the first particle has a spin right, the second particle has a spin left. No matter how the particles are oriented, their spins are always equal and opposite. Now suppose that we separate these two particles in some way that does not affect their spin, like electrically. One particle goes off in one direction and the other particle goes off in the opposite direction. The spin of a subatomic particle can be oriented by a magnetic field. For example, if a beam of electrons with randomly oriented spin is sent through a particular type of magnetic field, called a Stern-Gerlach device, the magnetic field splits the beam into two equal smaller beams. In one of them, all of the electrons have a spin up, and in the other, all of the electrons have a spin down. If only one electron goes through this magnetic field, it will come out of it with either a spin up or a spin down. We can design the experiment so that the odds are 50-50. If we reorientate the magnetic field, change its axis, we can give all of the electrons a spin right or a spin left instead of a spin up or a spin down. If only one electron goes through the magnetic field when it is oriented this way, it will come out of it with either a spin right or a spin left, equal chance either way. Now suppose that after we separate our original two-particle system, we send one of the particles through a magnetic field that will give it either a spin up or a spin down. In this case, let us say that the particle comes out of the magnetic field with a spin up. This means that we automatically know that the other particle has a spin down. We do not have to make a measurement on the other particle because we know that its spin is equal to and opposite to that of its twin. So, our experiment is conducted this way. The original two-particle system with zero spin is at the center. We separate the two particles. One of the particles goes to the right through a Stern-Gerlach device. In this case, the Stern-Gerlach device gives it a spin up. Therefore, we know without measuring that the other particle, which has gone to the left, has a spin down. Albert Einstein, Boris Podolsky, and Nathan Rosen thought up this experiment over 45 years ago. Actually, this version of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen experiment, using spin states, was thought up by David Bohm, a physicist at the University of London. This version usually is used to illustrate the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen effect. The original paper dealt with positions and momenta. In 1935, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen published their thought experiment in a paper entitled "Can Quantum Mechanical Description of Physical Reality Be Considered Complete?" At that time, Bohr, Heisenberg, and the proponents of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics were saying that quantum theory is a complete theory even though it doesn't provide any picture of the world separate from our observations of it. They're still saying it. The message that Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen wanted to convey to their colleagues was that the quantum theory is not a complete theory because it does not describe certain important aspects of reality which are physically real, even if they are not observed. The message that their colleagues got, however, was quite different. The message that their colleagues got was that the particles in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen thought experiment somehow are connected in a way that transcends our usual ideas about causality. For example, if the axis of the Stern-Gerlach device in our hypothetical experiment were changed to make the particles spin right or left instead of up or down, the experiment would look different. The particle shooting off to the right would have a spin right instead of a spin up. This means that the particle shooting off to the left would have a spin left instead of a spin down. Its spin is always equal and opposite to that of its twin. Now suppose that the axis of the Stern-Gerlach device is changed while the particles are in flight. Somehow, the particle traveling to the left knows that its twin to the right is spinning right instead of up, so it spins left instead of down. In other words, what we did to the right changed the axis of the magnetic field, affected what happened to the left. This strange phenomenon is known as the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen, or EPR, effect. Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen's thought experiment is the Pandora's box of modern physics. It inadvertently illustrated an unexplainable connectedness between particles in two different places. The particle to the left seems to know instantaneously the spin status of the particle to the right. This connectedness allows an experimenter in one place, the right, to affect the state of a system in another place, to the left. It is rather discomforting, remarked Erwin Schrödinger in reference to this phenomenon, that the quantum theory should allow a system to be steered or piloted into one or the other type of state at the experimenter's mercy, in spite of his having no access to it. At once, physicists realized that this peculiar situation raises a critical question. How can two of anything communicate so quickly? According to the usual ideas in physics, information is carried from one place to another by a signal. Without a carrier, there is no communication. For example, the most common form of communication is talking. The information that we convey by talking is carried in a face-to-face conversation by sound waves. Sound waves only travel so fast, about 700 miles per hour. Therefore, how long it takes my information to get from me to you depends upon how far away from me you are. The fastest communication signal is an electromagnetic wave, like a light wave or a radio wave. These travel at approximately 186,000 miles per second. Almost all of physics rests upon the assumption that nothing in the universe can travel faster than the speed of light. The extraordinarily high velocity of light makes communication by light signal seem instantaneous. I seem to see you nod your head at the moment that you actually do it. Nonetheless, communication by light signal is not instantaneous. How long it takes my information to travel via light signal from me to you depends upon how far away from me you are. In most instances, the travel time required is so brief that it scarcely can be measured. It takes several seconds, however, for a radio signal to travel from the Earth to the Moon and back. Now, suppose that the two areas in our Stern-Gerlach experiment are very far apart. It will take a certain amount of time for a light signal to travel from the area to the right to the area to the left. If the area to the right and the area to the left are so far apart that there is insufficient time for a light signal to connect an event that happens to the right with an event that happens to the left, there is no way, according to the usual ideas in physics, that the event to the left can know about the event to the right. Physicists call this a space-like separation. One event is space-like separated from another event if there is insufficient time for a light signal to connect them. Communication between space-like separated events defies one of the most basic assumptions of physics. Yet this is exactly what the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen thought experiment seems to illustrate. Even though they are space-like separated, the state of the particle shooting off to the left depends upon what the observer to the right decides to observe, or which way he orients his magnetic field. In other words, the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen effect indicates that information can be communicated at superluminal, faster than light, speeds, contrary to the accepted ideas of physics. If the two particles in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen thought experiment somehow are connected by a signal, that signal is traveling faster than the speed of light. Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen may have created the first scientific example of a superluminal connection. Einstein himself denied this conclusion. It is not possible, he argued, that the setting we choose for a measuring device here can affect what happens somewhere else. In his autobiography, written 11 years after the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper, he wrote, "On one supposition we should, in my opinion, absolutely hold fast. The real factual situation of the system S2, the particle to the left, is independent of what is done with the system S1, or the particle to the right, which is spatially separated from the former." This opinion is, in effect, the principle of local causes. The principle of local causes says that what happens in one area does not depend upon variables subject to the control of an experimenter in a distant space-like separated area. The principle of local causes is common sense. The results of an experiment in a place distant and space-like separated from us should not depend on what we decide to do or not to do right here. Except for the mother who rose an alarm at the same instant that her daughter's distant automobile crashed into a tree, and similar cases, the macroscopic world appears to be made of local phenomena. Since phenomena are local in nature, argued Einstein, quantum theory has a serious flaw. According to quantum theory, changing the measuring device to the right changes the wave function which describes the particle to the left. But, according to Einstein, it cannot change the real factual situation of the system S2, which is independent of what is done with the system S1. Therefore, one and the same factual situation to the left has two wave functions, one for each position of the measuring device to the right. This is a flaw, since it is impossible that two different types of wave functions should be coordinated with the identical factual situation of S2. Here's another way of looking at the same situation. Since the real factual situation to the left is independent of what is done to the right, there must exist simultaneously to the left a definite spin up or down and a definite spin right or left to account for all the results that we can get by orienting the Stern-Gerlach device to the right, either vertically or horizontally. Quantum theory is not able to describe such a state to the left, and therefore it is an incomplete theory. However, Einstein closed his argument with an incredible aside. One can escape from this conclusion, that quantum theory is incomplete, only by either assuming that the measurement of S1 telepathically changes the real situation of S2, or by denying independent real situations as such to things which are spatially separated from each other. Both alternatives appear to me entirely unacceptable. Although these alternatives were unacceptable to Einstein, they are being considered by physicists today. Few physicists believe in telepathy, but some physicists do believe either that at a deep and fundamental level there is no such thing as independent real situations of things which have interacted in the past, but which are spatially separated from each other, or that changing the measuring device to the right does change the real factual situation to the left. This brings us to Bell's theorem. Bell's theorem is a mathematical proof. What it proves is that if the statistical predictions of quantum theory are correct, then some of our common sense ideas about the world are profoundly mistaken. Bell's theorem does not demonstrate clearly in what way our common sense ideas about the world are inadequate. There are several possibilities. Each possibility has champions among the small number of physicists who are familiar with Bell's theorem. No matter which of the implications of Bell's theorem we favor, however, Bell's theorem itself leads to the inescapable conclusion that if the statistical predictions of quantum theory are correct, then our common sense ideas about the world are profoundly deficient. This is quite a conclusion because the statistical predictions of quantum mechanics are always correct. Quantum mechanics is the theory. It has explained everything from subatomic particles to transistors to stellar energy. It never has failed. It has no competition. Quantum physicists realized in the 1920s that our common sense ideas were inadequate for describing subatomic phenomena. Bell's theorem shows that common sense ideas are inadequate even to describe macroscopic events, events of the everyday world. As Henry Stapp wrote, "The important thing about Bell's theorem is that it puts the dilemma posed by quantum phenomena clearly into the realm of macroscopic phenomena. It shows that our ordinary ideas about the world are somehow profoundly deficient even on the macroscopic level." Bell's theorem has been reformulated in several ways since Bell published the original version in 1964. No matter how it is formulated, it projects the irrational aspects of subatomic phenomena squarely into the macroscopic domain. It says that not only do events in the realm of the very small behave in ways which are utterly different from our common sense view of the world, but also that events in the world at large, the world of freeways and sports cars, behave in ways which are utterly different from our common sense view of them. This incredible statement cannot be dismissed as fantasy because it is based upon the awesome and proven accuracy of the quantum theory itself. Bell's theorem is based upon correlations between paired particles, similar to the pair of hypothetical particles in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen thought experiment. For example, imagine a gas that emits light when it is electrically excited. Think of a neon sign. The excited atoms in the gas emit photons in pairs. The photons in each pair fly off in opposite directions. Except for the difference in their direction of travel, the photons in each pair are identical twins. If one of them is polarized vertically, the other one also is polarized vertically. If one of the photons in the pair is polarized horizontally, the other photon is also polarized horizontally. No matter what the angle of polarization, both photons in every pair are polarized in the same plane. Therefore, if we know the state of polarization of one of the particles, we automatically know the state of polarization of the other particle. This situation is similar to the situation in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen thought experiment, except that now we are discussing states of polarization instead of spin states. We can verify that both photons in each pair of photons are polarized in the same plane by actually sending them through polarizers. A light source in the center of our experiment emits a pair of photons. On each side of the light source, a polarizer is placed in the path of the emitted photon. Behind the polarizers are photomultiplier tubes which emit a click, or an inaudible electronic equivalent, whenever they detect a photon. Whenever the photomultiplier tube to the right of our light source emits a click, the photomultiplier tube to the left also emits a click. This is because both of the photons in each photon pair always are polarized in the same plane, and both of the polarizers in this arrangement are aligned in the same direction, in this case vertically. There is no theory involved here, just a matter of counting clicks. We know and can verify that when the polarizers both are aligned in the same direction, the photomultiplier tubes behind them will click an equal number of times. The clicks to the right are correlated with the clicks to the left. The correlation in this case is 1. Whenever one of the photomultiplier tubes clicks, the other photomultiplier tube always clicks as well. Now suppose that we orient one of the polarizers at 90 degrees to the other. One of the polarizers still is aligned vertically, but the other polarizer now is aligned horizontally. Light waves that pass through a vertical polarizer are stopped by a horizontal polarizer and the other way round. Therefore, when the polarizers are oriented at right angles to each other, a click to the right never will be accompanied by a click to the left. The clicks to the right again are correlated with the clicks to the left. This time, however, the correlation is 0. Whenever one of the photomultiplier tubes clicks, the other photomultiplier tube never clicks. There also are correlations between the clicks to the right and the clicks to the left for every other possible combination of polarizer settings between these two extremes. These statistical correlations can be predicted by the quantum theory. For a given setting of the polarizers, a certain number of clicks in one area will be accompanied by a certain number of clicks in the other area. Bell discovered that no matter what the settings of the polarizers, the clicks to the right are correlated too strongly to the clicks to the left to be explained by chance. They have to be connected somehow. However, if they are connected, then the principle of local causes, which says that what happens in one area does not depend upon variables subject to the control of an experimenter in a distant space-like area, is an illusion. In short, Bell's theorem shows that the principle of local causes, however reasonable it sounds, is mathematically incompatible with the assumption that the statistical predictions of quantum theory are valid, at least valid in this experiment and in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen experiment. The correlations which Bell used were calculated but untested predictions of the quantum theory. In 1964, this experiment was still a hypothetical construct. In 1972, John Clauser and Stuart Friedman at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory actually performed this experiment to confirm or disprove these predictions. They found that the statistical predictions upon which Bell based his theorem are correct. Bell's theorem not only suggests that the world is quite different than it seems, it demands it. There is no question about it. Something very exciting is happening. Physicists have proved, rationally, that our rational ideas about the world in which we live are profoundly deficient. In 1975, Henry Stapp, in a work supported by the U.S. Energy Research and Development Administration, wrote, "Bell's theorem is the most profound discovery of science." The deduction of superluminal communication from the results of the Clauser-Friedman experiment rests upon an important assumption, namely that the states of the measuring devices prior to the arrival of the photons to the right and to the left do not matter. This is, after all, a reasonable assumption. Normally, we say that the orientation of a measuring device prior to a measurement is not relevant to the result that we get at the time of a measurement. The result of an experiment depends upon the state of the measuring device at the time that the particle is detected by it, and not on the state of the measuring device before the particle gets there. However, superluminal communication cannot be deduced from the results of the Clauser-Friedman experiment without this assumption. Even though the photons in the photon pair cannot exchange information via light signals while they are in flight, each is traveling away from the other at the speed of light, the measuring device to the right and the measuring device to the left, which are set prior to the beginning of the experiment, may have exchanged information in the conventional manner, via light signals propagating within space-time. In other words, in the Clauser-Friedman experiment, the information about the setting of the measuring device in either region has sufficient time, traveling at the speed of light or less, to reach the other region before the particle arrives. In 1982, Alain Aspect, a physicist at the Institute of Optics, University of Paris in Orsay, France, conducted an experiment which was similar to the Clauser-Friedman experiment, but with one important difference. The settings on the measuring devices in Aspect's experiment could be changed at the last minute, or more precisely, at the last microsecond. Changing the settings on the measuring devices at the last minute ensures that information about the setting of the measuring device in either area does not have sufficient time, traveling at the speed of light or less, to reach the other region before the particle arrives. In other words, Aspect, in effect, performed Bohm's thought experiment. Like the Clauser-Friedman experiment and several Clauser-Friedman type experiments which have been performed in the meanwhile, Aspect's experiment verified the statistical predictions of quantum mechanics. Because Aspect's experiment, however, satisfied the conditions upon which the logical analysis leading to the phenomenon of superluminal transfer of information is based, that the area to the right and the area to the left are space-like separated, physicists were able to deduce this phenomenon solely on the basis of Aspect's experimental results. This lent considerable credence to the conclusion which Stapp had reached 5 years previously. Wrote Stapp, "Quantum phenomena provide prima facie evidence that information gets around in ways that do not conform to classical ideas. Thus, the idea that information is transferred superluminally is, a priori, not unreasonable. Everything we know about nature is in accord with the idea that the fundamental process of nature lies outside space-time, but generates events that can be located in space-time. The theorem of this paper supports this view of nature by showing that superluminal transfer of information is necessary, barring certain alternatives that seem less reasonable. Indeed, the reasonable philosophical position of Bohr seems to lead to the rejection of the other possibilities, hence, by inference, to the conclusion that superluminal transfer of information is necessary." Thus, 82 years after Planck presented his quantum hypothesis, physicists have been forced to consider the possibility, among others, that the superluminal transfer of information between space-like separated events may be an integral aspect of our physical reality. Bell's theorem showed that either the statistical predictions of quantum theory or the principle of local causes is false. It did not say which one is false, but only that both of them cannot be true. When Clauser and Friedman confirmed that the statistical predictions of quantum theory are correct, the startling conclusion was inescapable. The principle of local causes must be false. However, if the principle of local causes fails, and hence the world is not the way it appears to be, then what is the true nature of our world? There are several mutually exclusive possibilities. The first possibility, which we have just discussed, is that appearances to the contrary, there really may be no such thing as separate parts in our world. In the dialect of physics, locality fails. In that case, the idea that events are autonomous happenings is an illusion. This would be the case for any separate parts that have interacted with each other at any time in the past. When separate parts interact with each other, they, their wave functions, become correlated through the exchange of conventional signals or forces. Unless this correlation is disrupted by other external forces, the wave functions representing these separate parts remain correlated forever. For such correlated separate parts, what an experimenter does in this area has an intrinsic effect upon the results of an experiment in a distant space-like separated area. This possibility entails a faster-than-light communication of a type different than conventional physics can explain. In this picture, what happens here is intimately and immediately connected to what happens elsewhere in the universe, which in turn is intimately and immediately connected to what happens elsewhere in the universe, and so on, simply because the separate parts of the universe are not separate parts. Parts, wrote David Bohm, are seen to be an immediate connection in which their dynamical relationships depend in an irreducible way on the state of the whole system, and indeed on that of broader systems in which they are contained, extending ultimately and in principle to the entire universe. Thus one is led to a new notion of unbroken wholeness, which denies the classical idea of analyzability of the world into separately and independently existing parts. According to quantum mechanics, individual events are determined by pure chance. We can calculate, for example, that a certain percentage of spontaneous positive kaon decays will produce an anti-muon and a neutrino, 63%. A certain percentage will produce a positive pion and a neutral pion, 21%. A certain percentage will produce two positive pions and a negative pion, 5.5%. A certain percentage will produce a positron, a neutrino, and a neutral pion, 4.8%. A certain percentage will produce an anti-muon, a neutrino, and a neutral pion, 3.4%, and so on. However, quantum theory cannot predict which decay will produce which result. Individual events, according to quantum mechanics, are completely random. Said another way, the wave function which describes spontaneous kaon decays contains all of these possible results. When the decay actually happens, one of these potentialities is converted into an actuality. Even though the probability of each potentiality can be calculated, which potentiality actually happens at the moment of decay is a matter of chance. Bell's theorem implies that which decay reaction occurs at a certain time is not a matter of chance. Like everything else, it is dependent upon something which is happening elsewhere. In the words of Stapp, the conversion of potentialities into actualities cannot proceed on the basis of locally available information. If one accepts the usual ideas about how information propagates through space and time, then Bell's theorem shows that the macroscopic responses cannot be independent of faraway causes. This problem is neither resolved nor alleviated by saying that the response is determined by pure chance. Bell's theorem proves precisely that the determination of the macroscopic response must be non-chance, at least to the extent of allowing some sort of dependence of this response upon the faraway cause. Superluminal quantum connectedness seems to be, on the surface at least, a possible explanation for some types of psychic phenomena. Telepathy, for example, often appears to happen instantaneously, if not faster. Psychic phenomena have been held in disdain by physicists since the days of Newton. In fact, most physicists do not even believe that they exist. There are some notable exceptions, chief among which are Harold Puthoff and Russell Targ, whose experiments in remote viewing at the Stanford Research Institute are presented in their book Mind Reach, New York, Delacorte, 1977. In this sense, Bell's theorem could be the Trojan horse in the physicists' camp. First, because it proves that quantum theory requires connections that appear to resemble telepathic communication. And second, because it provides the mathematical framework through which serious physicists, all physicists are serious, could find themselves discussing types of phenomena which, ironically, they do not believe exist. The failure of the principle of local causes does not necessarily mean that superluminal connections actually exist. There are other ways to explain the failure of the principle of local causes. For example, the principle of local causes, that what happens in one area does not depend upon variables subject to the control of an experimenter in a distant space-like separated area, is based upon two tacit assumptions which are so obvious that they are easy to overlook. First, the principle of local causes assumes that we have a choice about how we perform our experiments. Imagine that we are doing Clauser and Friedman's photon experiment. We have before us a switch which determines how the polarizers will be positioned. If we throw the switch up, the polarizers are aligned with each other. If we throw the switch down, the polarizers are oriented at right angles with each other. Suppose that we decide to throw the switch up and align the polarizers. Normally, we assume that we could have thrown the switch down and oriented the polarizers at right angles if we had wanted to. In other words, we assume that we are free to decide whether the switch before us will be up or down when the experiment begins. The principle of local causes assumes variables subject to the control of an experimenter, quote-unquote, that we possess and can exercise a free will in the determination of how to perform our experiment. Second, and this is even easier to overlook, the principle of local causes assumes that if we had performed our experiment in a different way than we actually did perform it, we would have obtained some definite results. These two assumptions, that we can choose how to perform our experiment and that each of our choices, including those that we did not select, produces or would have produced definite results, is what Stapp calls contrafactual definiteness. The fact, in this case, is that we decide to perform our experiment with the switch in the up position. We assume that, contrary to this fact, contrafactually, we could have performed it with the switch in the down position. By performing the experiment with the switch in the up position, we obtained some definite results, a certain number of clicks in each area. Therefore, we assume that if we had chosen to perform the experiment with the switch in the down position, we likewise would have obtained some definite results. It is not necessary that we be able to calculate what these other results are. Odd as it may seem, some physical theories, as we shall see, do not assume that what would have happened if produces definite results. Since Bell's theorem shows that, assuming the validity of quantum theory, the principle of local causes is incorrect, and if we do not want to accept the existence of superluminal connections, the failure of locality, as the reason for the failure of the principle of local causes, then we are forced to confront the possibility that our assumptions about contrafactual definiteness are incorrect. Contrafactual definiteness fails. Since contrafactual definiteness has two parts, there are two ways in which contrafactual definiteness could fail. The first possibility is that free will is an illusion. Contrafactualness fails. Perhaps there is no such thing as what would have happened if. Perhaps there can be only what is. In this case, we are led to a superdeterminism. This is a determinism far beyond ordinary determinism. Ordinary determinism states that once the initial situation of a system is established, the future of the system also is established, since it must develop according to inexorable laws of cause and effect. This type of determinism was the basis of the great machine view of the universe. According to this view, however, if the initial situation of a system, like the universe, is changed, then the future of the system also is changed. According to superdeterminism, not even the initial situation of the universe could be changed. Not only is it impossible for things to be other than they are, it is even impossible that the initial situation of the universe could have been other than what it was. No matter what we are doing at any given moment, it is the only thing that ever was possible for us to be doing at that moment. Contrafactual definiteness also fails if the definiteness assumption in it fails. In this case, we do have a choice in the way that we perform our experiments, but what would have happened if does not produce any definite results. This alternative is just as strange as it sounds. It is also just what comes out of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. According to the many-worlds theory, whenever a choice is made in the universe between one possible event and another, the universe splits into different branches. In our hypothetical experiment, we decided to throw the switch into the up position. When the experiment was performed with the switch in the up position, it gave us a definite result, a certain number of clicks in each area. However, according to the many-worlds theory, at the moment that we threw the switch up, the universe split into two branches. In one branch, the experiment was performed with the switch in the up position. In the other branch, the experiment was performed with the switch in the down position. Who performed the experiment in the second branch? There's a different edition of us in each of the different branches of the universe. Each edition of us is convinced that our branch of the universe is the entirety of reality. The experiment in the second branch, the experiment which was performed with the switch in the down position, also produced a definite result, a certain number of clicks in each area. However, that result is in another branch of the universe, not in ours. Therefore, as far as we in this branch of the universe are concerned, what would have happened if actually did happen, and actually did produce definite results, but in a branch of the universe which is forever beyond our experiential reality? To summarize, Bell's theorem showed in 1964 that either the statistical predictions of quantum theory are false, or the principle of local causes is false. In 1972, Clauser and Friedman performed an experiment at Berkeley which validated the relevant statistical predictions of quantum theory. Therefore, according to Bell's theorem, the principle of local causes must be false. The principle of local causes says that what happens in one area does not depend upon variables subject to the control of an experimenter in a distant space-like separated area. The simplest way to explain the failure of the principle of local causes is to conclude that what happens in one area does depend upon variables subject to the control of an experimenter in a distant space-like separated area. If this explanation is correct, then we live in a non-local universe. Locality fails, characterized by superluminal, faster-than-light connections between apparently separate parts. However, there are other ways in which the principle of local causes can fail. The principle of local causes is based upon two tacit assumptions. The first tacit assumption is that we have the ability to determine our own actions, i.e., that we have a free will. The second tacit assumption is that when we choose to do one thing in place of another, what would have happened if would have produced definite results. These two assumptions together are what Stapp calls contrafactual definiteness. If the first assumption, contrafactualness, fails, then we are led to a superdeterminism which precludes the idea of alternative possibilities. According to this type of determinism, it is not possible that the world ever could have been other than it is. If the second assumption, definiteness, fails, then we are led to the many-worlds theory, in which the world continuously is splitting into separate and mutually inaccessible branches, each of which contains different editions of the same actors performing different acts at the same time on different stages, which somehow are located in the same place. There may be still other ways to understand the failure of the principle of local causes, but the very fact that it must fail means that the world is in some way profoundly different from our ordinary ideas about it. Perhaps we really are living in a dark cave. There is a no-models option, which is, in effect, the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. In 1927, the most famous assemblage of physicists in history decided that it might not ever be possible to construct a model of reality, i.e., to explain the way things really are behind the scenes. Despite the tidal wave of knowledge, quote-unquote, which has swept over us for 40 years, the fundamental physics group found it necessary, like the physicists at Copenhagen a half-century before them, to acknowledge that it might not be possible to construct a model of reality. This acknowledgement is more than a recognition of the limitations of this theory or that theory. It is a recognition emerging throughout the West that knowledge itself is limited. Said another way, it is a recognition of the difference between knowledge and wisdom. Classical science starts with the assumption of separate parts which together constitute physical reality. Since its inception, it has concerned itself with how these separate parts are related. Newton's great work showed that the Earth, the Moon, and the planets are governed by the same laws as falling apples. The French mathematician Descartes invented a way of drawing pictures of relationships between different measurements of time and distance. This process, analytic geometry, is a wonderful tool for organizing a wealth of scattered data into one meaningful pattern. Herein lies the strength of Western science. It brings huge tracts of apparently unrelated experience into a rational framework of simple concepts like the laws of motion. The starting point of this process is a mental attitude which initially perceives the physical world as fragmented and different experiences as logically unrelated. Newtonian science is the effort to find the relationships between pre-existing separate parts. Quantum mechanics is based upon the opposite epistemological assumption. Thus, there are profound differences between Newtonian mechanics and quantum theory. The most fundamental difference between Newtonian physics and quantum mechanics is the fact that quantum mechanics is based upon observations, measurements. Without a measurement of some kind, quantum mechanics is mute. Quantum mechanics says nothing about what happens between measurements. In Heisenberg's words, the term happens is restricted to the observation. This is very important, for it constitutes a philosophy of science unlike any before it. We commonly say, for example, that we detect an electron at point A and then at point B, but strictly speaking, this is incorrect. According to quantum mechanics, there was no electron which traveled from point A to point B. There are only the measurements that we made at point A and at point B. Quantum theory not only is closely bound to philosophy, but also, and this is becoming increasingly apparent, to theories of perception. As early as 1932, von Neumann explored this relation in his Theory of Measurement. Exactly when does the wave function associated with a particle collapse? When the particle strikes a photographic plate? When the photographic plate is developed? When the light rays from the developed photographic plate strike our retina? When the nerve impulses from the retina reach our brain? Bohr's principle of complementarity also addresses the underlying relation of physics to consciousness. The experimenter's choice of experiment determines which mutually exclusive aspect of the same phenomenon, wave or particle, will manifest itself. Likewise, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle demonstrates that we cannot observe a phenomenon without changing it. The physical properties which we observe in the external world are enmeshed in our own perceptions, not only psychologically, but ontologically as well. The second most fundamental difference between Newtonian physics and quantum theory is that Newtonian physics predicts events, and quantum mechanics predicts the probability of events. According to quantum mechanics, the only determinable relation between events is statistical, that is, a matter of probability. David Bohm, professor of physics at Birkbeck College, University of London, proposes that quantum physics is, in fact, based upon a perception of a new order. According to Bohm, we must turn physics around. Instead of starting with parts and showing how they work together, the Cartesian order, we start with the whole. Bohm's theory is compatible with Bell's theorem. Bell's theorem implies that the apparently separate parts of the universe could be intimately connected at a deep and fundamental level. Bohm asserts that the most fundamental level is an unbroken wholeness, which is, in his words, that which is. All things, including space, time, and matter, are forms of that which is. There is an order which is enfolded into the very process of the universe, but that enfolded order may not be readily apparent. For example, imagine a large hollow cylinder into which is placed a smaller cylinder. The space between the smaller cylinder and the larger cylinder is filled with a clear, viscous liquid like glycerin. Such a device actually exists. Now suppose that we deposit a small droplet of ink in the surface of the glycerin. Because of the nature of the glycerin, the ink drop remains intact, a well-defined black spot floating on a clear liquid. If we begin to rotate one of the cylinders, say in a clockwise direction, the drop of ink spreads out in the opposite direction, making a line which grows thinner and thinner until it disappears altogether. The ink droplet now is enfolded completely into the glycerin, but it is still there. When we rotate the cylinder in the opposite direction, the ink droplet reappears. A fine line appears, which grows thicker and thicker and then collects into a single point. If we continue the counterclockwise motion of the cylinder, the same thing happens, but in reverse. We can repeat this process as often as we like. Each time, the ink spot becomes a fine line and disappears into the glycerin, only to reappear again when the motion of the glycerin is reversed. If it requires one complete revolution of the cylinder clockwise to make the droplet disappear completely, one complete revolution of the cylinder counterclockwise will make it reappear in its original shape and location. The number of revolutions required to make the droplet disappear or reappear is the enfolded order. Bohm calls this enfolded order the implicate order, which means the same thing. Suppose that we deposit a drop of ink on the surface of the glycerin, revolve the cylinder clockwise until the drop disappears, one revolution, add a second drop of ink to the glycerin, continue to revolve the cylinder in the same direction until it disappears, one more revolution, and then add a third drop of ink to the glycerin and revolve the cylinder one more revolution until the third drop also disappears. Now we have three ink drops enfolded into the glycerin. None of them are visible, but we know where each of them is in the implicate order. When we resolve the cylinder in the opposite direction, one drop of ink, the third, appears after one revolution, another drop of ink, the second, appears after the next revolution, and another drop of ink, the first, appears after the third revolution. This is the unfolded or explicate order. The three ink droplets appear to be unrelated in the explicate, unfolded order, but we know that they are related in the implicate, enfolded order. If we consider the condensation of ink droplets in this experiment as particles, we have Bohm's hypothesis of apparently random subatomic phenomena. Particles may appear in different places, yet be connected in the implicate order. In Bohm's words, particles may be discontiguous in space, the explicate order, but contiguous in the implicate order. Matter is a form of the implicate order as a vortex is a form of the water. It is not reducible to smaller particles. Like matter and everything else, particles are forms of the implicate order. If this is difficult to grasp, it is because our minds demand to know what is the implicate order of. The implicate order is the implicate order of that which is. However, that which is the implicate order. This worldview is so different from the one that we are using that, as Bohm points out, description is totally incompatible with what we want to say. Description is incompatible with what we want to say because our thinking is based upon an ancient Greek mode of thought. According to this mode of thought, only being is. Therefore, non-being is not. This way of thinking gives us a practical tool for dealing with the world, but it doesn't describe what happens. Actually, non-being also is. Both being and non-being are that which is. Everything, even emptiness, is that which is. There is nothing which is not that which is. This way of looking at reality raises the question of the consciousness of the observer. Our minds demand to know what is the implicate order of, because our culture has taught us to perceive only the explicate order, the Cartesian view. Things, to us, are intrinsically separate. Bohm's physics require, in his words, a new instrument of thought. A new instrument of thought, such as is needed to understand Bohm's physics, however, would radically alter the consciousness of the observer, reorientating it toward a perception of the unbroken wholeness of which everything is a form. However, such a perception would not cause an inability to see the explicate order. Bohm's physics contains an element of relativity parallel to that of Einstein's theories. The implicate or explicate nature of order, or order of nature, depends upon the perspective of the viewer. The problem is that our present viewpoint is limited to the perspective of the explicate order. From the perspective of the implicate order, the apparently separate elements of the explicate order are intimately related. Even the phrases elements and intimately related imply a Cartesian separateness which does not exist. At the fundamental level of that which is, the separate elements which are intimately related in the implicate order are the implicate order. The requirement for a new instrument of thought upon which to base Bohm's physics may not be as much of an obstacle as it first appears. There already exists an instrument of thought based upon an unbroken wholeness. Furthermore, there exist a number of sophisticated psychologies distilled from 2,000 years of practice and introspection whose sole purpose is to develop this thought instrument. These psychologies are what we commonly call Eastern religions. Eastern religions differ considerably among themselves. It would be a mistake to equate Hinduism, for example, with Buddhism, even though they are more like each other than either one of them is like a religion of the West. Nonetheless, all Eastern religions, or psychologies, are compatible in a very fundamental way with Bohm's physics and philosophy. All of them are based upon the experience of a pure, undifferentiated reality, which is that which is. While it would be naive to overstate the similarities between Bohm's physics and Eastern philosophies, it would be foolish to ignore them. Consider, for example, the following sentences. The word reality is derived from the roots thing, R-E-S, or race, and think, R-E-V-I, or revi. Reality means everything you can think about. That is not that which is. No idea can capture truth in the sense of that which is. The ultimate perception does not originate in the brain or any material structure, although a material structure is necessary to manifest it. The subtle mechanism of knowing the truth does not originate in the brain. There is a similarity between thought and matter. All matter, including ourselves, is determined by information. Information is what determines space and time. Taken out of context, there is no absolute way of knowing whether these statements were made by Professor Bohm or a Tibetan Buddhist. In fact, these sentences were excerpted from different parts of two physics lectures that Professor Bohm gave at Berkeley in April 1977. The first lecture was given on the campus to physics students. The second lecture was given in the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory to a group of professional physicists. Two of these three statements were taken from the second lecture, the one given to the advanced physicists. It is ironic that while Bohm's theories are received with some skepticism by most professional physicists, they would find an immediately sympathetic reception among the thousands of people in our culture who have turned their backs on science in their own quest for the ultimate nature of reality. If Bohm's physics, or one similar to it, should become the main thrust of physics in the future, the dances of East and West could blend in exquisite harmony. Physics curricula of the 21st century could include classes in meditation. The function of Eastern religions, or psychologies, is to allow the mind to escape the confines of the symbolic. According to this view, everything is a symbol, not only words and concepts, but also people and things. Beyond the confines of the symbolic lies that which is, pure awareness, the experience of the suchness of reality. Nonetheless, every Eastern religion resorts to the use of symbols to escape the realm of the symbolic. Some disciplines use symbols more than others, but all of them use symbols in one form or another. Therefore, the question arises, if pure awareness is considered distinct from the content of awareness, in what ways specifically does the content of awareness affect the realization of pure awareness? What types of content prompt the mind to leap forward? What enables it to activate the self-fulfilling capability to transcend itself? It is very difficult to answer this question. Any answer is only a point of view. A point of view itself is limiting. To understand something is to give up some other way of conceiving it. This is another way of saying that the mind deals in forms of limitation. Nonetheless, there is a relationship between the content of awareness and the ability of the mind to transcend itself. Reality is what we take to be true. What we take to be true is what we believe. What we believe is based upon our perceptions. What we perceive depends upon what we look for. What we look for depends upon what we think. What we think depends upon what we perceive. What we perceive determines what we believe. What we believe determines what we take to be true. What we take to be true is our reality. The central focus of this process, initially at any rate, is what we think. We at least can say that allegiance to a symbol of openness, Christ, Buddha, Krishna, the infinite diversity of nature, etc., seems to open the mind, and that an open mind is often the first step in the process of enlightenment. The psychological gestalt of physics has shifted radically in the last century to one of extreme openness. In the middle 1800s, Newtonian mechanics was at its zenith. There seemed to be no phenomenon which could not be explained in terms of mechanical models. All mechanical models were subject to long-established principles. The chairman of the physics department at Harvard discouraged graduate study because so few important matters remained unsolved. In a speech to the Royal Institution in 1900, Lord Kelvin reflected that there were only two clouds on the horizon of physics, the problem of blackbody radiation and the Michelson-Morley experiment. There was no doubt, said Kelvin, that they soon would be gone. He was wrong. Kelvin's two clouds signaled the end of the era that began with Galileo and Newton. The problem of blackbody radiation led to Planck's discovery of the quantum of action. Within 30 years, the entirety of Newtonian physics became a special limiting case of the newly developing quantum theory. The Michelson-Morley experiment foreshadowed Einstein's famous theories of relativity. By 1927, the foundations of the new physics, quantum mechanics, and relativity were in place. In contrast to Kelvin's time, the allegiance of physicists today is to a symbol of extreme openness. Isidore Rabi, Nobel Prize winner and chairman emeritus of the physics department at Columbia University, wrote in 1975, "I don't think that physics will ever have an end. I think that the novelty of nature is such that its variety will be infinite, not just in changing forms, but in the profundity of insight and the newness of ideas." Staff wrote in 1971, "Human inquiry can continue indefinitely to yield important new truths." The "what we think" of physicists today is that the physics of nature, like human experience itself, is infinitely diverse. Eastern religions have nothing to say about physics, but they have a great deal to say about human experience. In Hindu mythology, Kali, the divine mother, is the symbol for the infinite diversity of experience. Kali represents the entire physical plane. She is the drama, tragedy, humor, and sorrow of life. She is the brother, father, sister, mother, lover, and friend. She is the fiend, monster, beast, and brute. She is the sun and the ocean. She is the grass and the dew. She is our sense of accomplishment and our sense of doing worthwhile. Our thrill of discovery is a pendant on her bracelet. Our gratification is a spot of color on her cheek. Our sense of importance is the bell on her toe. This full and seductive, terrible and wonderful Earth Mother always has something to offer. Hindus know the impossibility of seducing her or conquering her and the futility of loving her or hating her, so they do the only thing that they can do. They simply honor her. In a particular story, Kali, the Divine Mother, is Sita, the wife of God. Ram is God. Ram, Sita, and Laksaman, who is Ram's brother, are walking along a jungle trail. The path is so narrow that most of the time Laksaman can see only Sita, who walks between him and Ram. Every so often, however, the path turns in such a way that Laksaman can see his brother, God. These powerful metaphors have application to the developing drama of physics. Although most physicists have little patience, professionally, with metaphors, physics itself has become a powerful metaphor. 20th century physics is the story of a journey from intellectual entrenchment to intellectual openness, despite the conservative, prove-it-to-me nature of individual physicists. The realization that the discoveries of physics never will end has brought physicists, as well as those who have followed the story of physics, to an extremely fertile plateau. This realization invites the intellect to leap forward, although at great risk to its present hegemony. The Wu Li masters know that physicists are doing more than discovering the endless diversity of nature. They are dancing with Kali, the divine mother of Hindu mythology. Buddhism is both a philosophy and a practice. Buddhist philosophy is rich and profound. Buddhist practice is called Tantra. Tantra is the Sanskrit word meaning to weave. There is little that can be said about Tantra. It must be done. Buddhist philosophy reached its ultimate development in the 2nd century A.D. No one has been able to improve much on it since then. The distinction between Buddhist philosophy and Tantra is well defined. Buddhist philosophy can be intellectualized. Tantra cannot. Buddhist philosophy is a function of the rational mind. Tantra transcends rationality. The most profound thinkers of the Indian civilization discovered that words and concepts could take them only so far. Beyond that point came the actual doing of a practice, the experience of which was ineffable. This did not prevent them from progressively refining the practice into an extremely effective and sophisticated set of techniques, but it did prevent them from being able to describe the experiences which these techniques produce. The practice of Tantra does not mean the end of rational thought. It means the integration of thought based on symbols into larger spectrums of awareness. Enlightened people still remember their zip codes. The development of Buddhism in India shows that a profound and penetrating intellectual quest into the ultimate nature of reality can culminate in, or at least set the stage for, a quantum leap beyond rationality. In fact, on an individual level, this is one of the roads to enlightenment. Tibetan Buddhism calls it the path without form, or the practice of mind. The path without form is prescribed for people of intellectual temperament. The science of physics is following a similar path. The development of physics in the 20th century already has transformed the consciousness of those involved with it. The study of complementarity, the uncertainty principle, quantum field theory, and the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics produces insights into the nature of reality very similar to those produced by the study of Eastern philosophy. The profound physicists of this century increasingly have become aware that they are confronting the ineffable. Max Planck, the father of quantum mechanics, wrote, "Science means unresting endeavor and continually progressing development toward an aim which the poetic intuition may apprehend, but which the intellect can never fully grasp." We are approaching the end of science. The end of science does not mean the end of the unresting endeavor and continually progressing development of more and more comprehensive and useful physical theories. Enlightened physicists remember their zip codes too. The end of science means the coming of Western civilization in its own time and in its own way into the higher dimensions of human experience. Professor G.F. Chu, chairman of the physics department at Berkeley, remarked in reference to a theory of particle physics, "Our current struggle with certain aspects of advanced physics may thus be only a foretaste of a completely new form of human intellectual endeavor, one that will not only lie outside physics, but will not even be describable as scientific." We need not make a pilgrimage to India or Tibet. There is much to learn there, but here at home, in the most inconceivable of places, amidst the particle accelerators and computers, our own path without form is emerging. Al Huang, the Tai Chi master who created the metaphor of Wu Li, once wrote, "Sooner or later we reach a dead end when we talk." He could as well have said that sooner or later we go round in circles when we talk, since going round in a circle is one kind of dead end. As we sat in a cabin at Esalen and talked late into the night, my new friend David Finkelstein spoke to us softly. "I think it would be misleading to call particles the entities involved in the most primitive events of the theory, quantum topology, because they don't move in space and time, they don't carry mass, they don't have charge, they don't have energy in the usual sense of the word." Question: so what is it that makes events at that level? Answer: who are the dancers and who the dance? They have no attributes other than the dance. Question: what is they? Answer: the things that dance, the dancers. My God, we're back to the title of the book. This concludes the reading of The Dancing Wu Li Masters, An Overview of the New Physics, by Gary Zukav. This book was read by Grover Gardner.